This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is on vacation this week. Last week, we covered the long-awaited tentative agreement between the Boston Teachers Union and the school department, which it's hoped will enact sweeping changes to the way teachers are hired, evaluated, and promoted. The reaction to the agreement has been largely positive, with many calling it a win for the city's children. But not everyone feels it represents the kind of change that's needed or the right conversation about our public schools. Jamaica Plain author Susan Neymark moved to Boston in 1975, just as court-ordered desegregation and the busing crisis were tearing much of the city apart. Racial tension, class division, and inequality define the struggle that Susan joined more than 20 years ago when she first signed on to a parent committee of her eldest son's school in Dorchester. She became a school activist and eventually served 8 years on the Boston School Committee. Now, the mother of two now adult sons, has written a memoir, The Education of a White Parent, Wrestling with Race and Opportunity in the Boston Public Schools. In the book, Susan Neymark writes that she's convinced that we will never unravel the obstacles to our public schools working well for all children without addressing the legacy of racism. And Susan Neymark, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you for coming in. It was a fascinating read. But let's start. Your eldest son, Ben, started school in 1985. This was when you first noticed sort of racial inequalities in the system. Tell us what you observed.
Well, I would say right from the start, I probably observed less initially than as I went into it, but I certainly saw differences in how the schools interacted with the kids and with the parents, and I saw right from the beginning that the white parents were much more engaged in the schools. My kids went to a school at the time that was about 15% maybe white kids, and I would go to the parent meetings, and it was over half white parents, and I was surprised by that. And then I started to slowly over time notice other things, that the things in the school that were more by choice that kids were selected for, like being on the student newspaper or in the choir, were mostly white kids in a school that was mostly kids of color. And it didn't seem right. And I got involved as a parent with the parent council. And the more questions I asked, the more I felt like I uncovered a whole side to the dynamics in the schools that people just, for the most part, weren't talking about.
Yeah, and let me add, I mean, there are a couple of really, more than a couple, there are a few real interesting cases in point. There's a chapter early in the book called No Crayons, No Paper. You write about what happened when one of your sons is transferred to the William Monroe Trotter Elementary School. And there's a line in the chapter that summed up a lot to me. You wrote that when you sort of made this discovery, so this is what inequality looks like. And what did you find there? I mean, just tell that story a little bit about No Crayons, No Paper.
So this was a school, the Trotter School, that was considered a pretty good school back then. And we got to the beginning of the school year when my older son was in kindergarten. And the kindergarten classroom literally had no crayons, no papers, no basic supplies for the kids. And I thought, how can this be? You know, what do you do with five-year-olds all day without that kind of basic supplies? And I went to a parent council meeting and discovered that, in fact, that, you know, that's what was going on. The principal said, well, I ordered the supplies. And it just dumbfounded me that something that basic couldn't be figured out by a school system.
Yeah. And so what did you do? How did you sort of approach these issues? And what did you see while you did it?
Well, my tendency was to get with other parents because I felt like if it's not just me, you have kind of more weight to get things addressed. And, you know, on that particular issue, we had a big debate at the parent council meeting. Do we go out and buy pencils and paper because the kids are, you know, without those basic supplies, or do we get the school system to do its job? And there was huge arguments on both sides because the school system should do its job. But how long would that take? And I think we ended up kind of proceeding on both fronts because we felt like the kids needed to come into school and have crayons and have paper. But we also wanted to see the school system to do its job. And I think that kind of was how things went for a lot of years. You kind of scramble to make things work for the kids, but a lot of people will do that without necessarily addressing the systemic problem, and then you're just forever scrambling, because if you solve it once but you don't get at the higher level of what's wrong, you're forever trying to solve the same problem over and over again. And it felt to me like that's kind of the pattern that too many schools and families were just too used to.
And now your book, I mean, you talk a lot about this, the legacy of inequality and the legacy of racism in these schools. And one of the ways it seems to be played out is it's not so much an overt racism, or put it in your words, but this, I mean, you made reference to this just a moment ago, and that is this idea that it's the white parents who were really in a position to access the information and make the changes that were necessary, or at least had a better chance at making those changes. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that told you about the way the schools are being run?
Yeah, I think what it told me has shifted over the years the more I got involved. But, for example, what I heard a lot as I got more involved, and I hear it to this day, is that, white parents saying that parents of color obviously don't care about their kids, and that's why they're not involved, and that's why the kids don't do as well at school. And that's still said to this day. And people don't necessarily say that in mixed company or to someone's face, but it's the kind of thing I see in email comments still, and I saw back then, I saw when I was on school committee. And when I looked into it and I realized there are other things going on, that parents of color often felt intimidated by the school, they didn't feel as welcome, and myself as a white parent wouldn't necessarily know that because it's not how I'm treated. And so when a parent of color says, well, I was treated differently, I think it's too easy as for me as a white parent to say, oh, can't be, you know, because we didn't experience it. And then I did a little bit of research in writing this book to kind of understand where does that come from, and found that the Black community in Boston had been petitioning the school committee for access to equality schools since 1798. 1800, 1840, 1840s, all through the 1840s. And so when you look at that, it's over 200 years of Black parents being organized and saying, we're not getting the same as white parents. And I think it's too easy for us as white parents or white people in the community to dismiss and minimize that legacy and what it does to all of us.
Yeah. And what about what it does to the students themselves? I was struck by early in the book, you referenced some studies that show Black kids, Black boys, are punished more frequently and more severely than their white counterparts. They're suspended more frequently. They're tracked into special ed more quickly, this kind of thing. So you are still seeing these rather stark differences between white kids and Black kids.
Yeah, yeah. And those trends continue. They continue, and that's troubling in an era when we think we've gotten past some of that stuff. But I don't think it's so much that the Black kids are getting in more trouble. And I think what we overlook is that the white boys get in trouble too, but we tend to dismiss it as boys will be boys. Mm. And even when my own sons, who are white, were teenagers, they both had their minor scuffles with the law in Boston, like lots of kids do. And they both basically had their wrists slapped and were sent home. And their friends of color, it escalated to a whole different thing just based on kind of how they were viewed, how they reacted. You know, you could look at it as a whole pattern that they've internalized based on, again, generations of a certain level of hostility. And so some of it is not as blatant, but those same patterns continue.
Mm. Susan, it's been more than 20 years since then, since you first put your boys into school. They're grown up, and I'm going to ask you a little later about how they did. But the troubling thing that I got from your book is that things haven't really changed. And I wanted to ask you how racial disparity continues to manifest itself, continues to show up in Boston public schools these days.
I think when you look at discipline issues, when you look at special ed, you'll still see that kids of color are, disproportionately channeled into special ed for behavior, not for, you know, necessarily learning disabilities that are documented by a doctor. You still see the achievement gap in test scores, the exam schools, without the racial quotas that were dropped a while ago now, are increasingly white. And, you know, if you start with a fundamental belief, which not all people have, but I do, that all kids have equal potential, you have to kind of look at what's going on that those differences are still so present in terms of just the gaps in opportunity and in where the kids end up.
Listeners, we're talking to Susan Neymark. She's an education consultant and the author of the memoir, The Education of a White Parent, Wrestling with Race and Opportunity in the Boston Public Schools. She is a Jamaica Plain mother of two boys who went through the Boston Public School system. And what's your view on the legacy of race and inequality of opportunity in the Boston Public Schools? Does what you're hearing from Susan Neymark ring true to you? If so, what has to happen? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me introduce another guest who's been sitting patiently here in the studio, Gloria Fernandez. She's a mother of two boys. Gloria, good to have you. Thanks for coming
in.
Good
afternoon. Thank you.
And I should just say that you've also been involved with the Boston Public School System, both as a parent and as a family and community outreach coordinator for Boston Public Schools. You've also been an advocate for Black parents of special needs students.
The Federation Parents of Special Needs.
And let me point out for our listeners that you're African American, and so I want to talk to you as an African American mother in the public school system. You were involved in parents groups. What do you hear in Susan's case here? Does it ring true to you?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. You know me as African American. My name doesn't appear to be African American. Mm-hmm. Fernandez with a Z at the end. I sometimes am privy to a different kind of attitude, perhaps, because people are not sure necessarily what my origin is. Okay. So answering your question in regards to Susan's experience, unfortunately, my experience has been within the last 10 years, and I'd have to agree with Susan, and it makes you sad when you really look at it. I'm originally from Cambridge, which was very diverse, and my oldest child had started in Cambridge, and I did see differences in being encouraged to go into my first parent council, and I was at a school in Roslindale, and going in, and I was the only parent of color. I was never really asked to participate, not giving any real responsibility. And because of my own insecurities as being a new parent, I really didn't push it, but I would have appreciated maybe a little hand-holding and how to navigate through the system. Mm-hmm. So it was all brand new. I think when you're a parent and you're brand new and maybe you're feeling a little insecure sometimes about just that whole aspect, it's kind of tricky to move around. I felt that things could have been different for me had I maybe presented myself a different way. Being an FCOC, a Family Community Outreach Coordinator, I had opportunities to deal with parents that did not have college educations. I was pursuing my college education at the time. And it's really different, like, once you let people know what your educational background is, how they kind of almost ease down, talk a little more comfortably, feel that you're more of a peer. And I think that's probably one of the most difficult things that people of color have to deal with, African-American parents, is not really being felt like your peer.
Susan, what do you hear in Gloria's statement there? Because, I mean, it seemed like you had quite a challenge sort of figuring out how to navigate the Boston public school system to get what you needed to get in terms of, whether it was concerns about too few monitors on the school buses or no crayons and paper in the classroom. But I gather you feel like you had a sort of a set of advantages in navigating that system that Gloria might not have had.
I think I had a comfort level that mm-hmm. I wasn't even aware of, but it's more likely when you're white and college educated that you go in feeling entitled. Here's the rules and they ought to be following them, and I'm going to do what I need to see that they follow them. And, you know, I think Gloria pointed out an interesting point, because it's race and it's also class mm-hmm. and it's also perception, and that people often say, well, aren't the dynamics the same for poor white families? And there are challenges for poor white families, and I think it's the convergence of race and class that's kind of the biggest barrier. And so when people, as Gloria described, you know, in the school, assume you're uneducated, see that you're a person of color, you know, I didn't get treated in the way that parents that looked like that and came across like that got treated.
We've got some callers on the line. I want to get them involved in the conversation as soon as possible. So let's go to Bambi, who's calling from Rowley. Bambi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the things I've been listening to throughout the summer, expectations make such a difference.
Expectations. You dropped out there, Bambi, but the key word there was expectations. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. How children thrive, it depends so much on what is expected of them. And if teachers are thinking that a kid is not going to do well, then they're not going to do well. And that's why these kids keep getting thrown under the bus, basically, with discipline issues, special ed, as your person was talking about. And in the evaluations of teachers, I think it's so important to somehow retrain them that they've got to expect that every kid can do well. And that's got to be like a retraining of the teacher's mindset.
Bambi, thanks so much for that call. Let me come to both of you. Susan, I'll start with you. This key point about expectations and bringing that set of expectations to all kids in an equal way, I think, is what we're talking about in the context of this conversation.
And I think that caller had a very good point. And, you know, one of the things that's different nowadays from way back is that most white people don't want to think of themselves as racist. And so we want to believe we have the same expectations and treat everybody equally. But I think, and this has been backed up by a number of studies, that we still have implicit bias is what they call it in the research. You know, biases that we're not aware of that affect how we treat people in ways that aren't necessarily so obvious, but the kids pick up on, and in fact, they do affect how, you know, how we interact with the kids.
Mm. Gloria, you eventually, if I understand it correctly, took your son out of the public school system and placed him in a private school. Right?
I did.
Yeah. Tell me why and what difference you found in doing that.
Why did I do it? Both of my children went... like I said, my oldest one started in Cambridge Public Schools and was at a charter school in Cambridge and then was in Boston Public Schools. Let me just break a little bit and talk about the expectation.
Sure.
I was working at Lesley College and attending Lesley College. My oldest one was having difficulties in school. I took an opportunity to have an internship teaching and spend more time with my child. Also at that time, I knew I had to make the focus on this little person, mm-hmm. okay, who was in third grade, and telling him how much I expected and how I knew that he could do it. By fourth grade, this child was in the advanced classes. By fifth grade, was scoring on the SRI, the Standard Reading Index, like 11th grade level. Middle school, I decided not to go for private school because I was concerned about the class issue under advisement of an elder that said to me, you know, this could be a problem. Middle school killed my oldest child, I think, mm-hmm. on some level. You go from a classroom that has 9 to 11 kids and you have this teacher that had been in private schools for years and who just helped you to flourish, and then you get to a school that has 35 kids, and a teacher literally looked at me and said, I have 100 other children. I really don't have a lot of time to spend on you with your child right now. That's heartbreaking for any parent, black, white, green, or yellow, as my old auntie would say. That child did eventually go to an exam school for high school, but it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand? Mm-hmm. So this same little, now my little one, it's going to the advanced classes, started off at the Hale, did very well. Same teacher for second and third grade, ended up in advanced classes. This kid had just as much potential, but I could see the borderline, where the other one got more kind of sad, this one would have went to the foolish side.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember this little person at 5 years old walking by a Range Rover and said, Mom, I'm going to build you one and buy you one. He always wanted to be an engineer from very young. I didn't think from working in the Boston middle schools that he was going to have an opportunity to really get a taste of what engineering and that hands-on kind of tactical stuff that he needed to do what he needed to do with his life. So that was the reason why I took him out.
I see. Well, I want to ask a related question of you, Susan, and that is your two boys, they're grown up now. How in the long run did they fare in Boston public schools?
They fared fine. They fared fine. They both ended up at Boston Latin School, which many people would give their oldest child to get the rest in there. It's, you know, it's a very well-endowed school, lots of opportunity. And the older one just finished graduate school, Ivy League graduate school. And he's kind of like me doing work related to you know, social change. And the younger one kind of took his own route. But he would have these conversations in high school with his friends because he was not such an inspired student, shall we say. It took pressing to just keep him kind of afloat at Latin school. And he had friends that were in other high schools in Boston. And they would have these conversations that they were better off coming out at the bottom of the top than at the top of the bottom. So even, you know, at whatever age that would have been, 16, 17, he understood that as much as he didn't necessarily love the rigidity and the rigor at Latin school, that even if he slid by there, he would come out with a more solid education than if he had gone elsewhere in Boston. And, you know, I hadn't really put non-public schools on the table as an option for him. But, you know, I think they both did learn how to work with less than perfect circumstances and kind of get what you need. And that's an important skill.
And let me ask you both, we literally have 30 seconds left, so it's sort of unfair to ask this with so little time left, but what has to happen? Because Susan, your book lays out the sort of challenges that have to do with this legacy of racism and inequality in the schools. How do we address that going forward?
I think we need to learn to have conversations about it, and there are schools doing that. There's schools bringing in the YWCA, there's schools working with the Achievement Gap Office in the Boston Public Schools to do training, and they're just having the space for those kind of conversations within the schools.
Gloria, last word to you.
Acknowledging post-traumatic stress disorder in terms of slavery and discrimination, it hurts people. You have to talk about it.
So still work to do. We've come a long way, but perhaps we still have a long way to go. Sounds like you're both saying. Susan Neymark, education consultant and author of the memoir, The Education of a White Parent, Wrestling with Race and Opportunity in the Boston Public Schools. Thank you so much for coming in. And Susan will be giving a book talk at the South End Library on Thursday, September 20th. That's at 6:30 p.m., open to the public. And Gloria Fernandez, thank you for coming in. What a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, folk musician and novelist Scott Alaric joins us to talk about his book, Revival. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.